the forest while they went by. Jerry was very good and didn't cry. The picture brought a lump to Caris's throat. But, she swallowed. But why did you run away? Because my husband wants to kill me, Tilly said. And she burst into tears. Caris sat her down and Merthyn brought her a cup of wine. They let her sob. Caris sat on the bench beside her and put an arm around her shoulders while Merthyn cradled baby Jerry. When at last Tilly had cried herself out, Caris said, "What has Ralph done?" Tilly shook her head. "Nothing. It's just the way he looks at me. I know he wants to murder me." Merthyn muttered, "I wish I could say my brother is incapable of that." Caris said, "But why would he want to do such a terrible thing?"
"I don't know," Tilly said miserably. "Ralph went to Uncle William's funeral. There was a lawyer from London there, Sir Gregory Longfellow."
"I know him," Caris said. "A clever man, but I don't like him."
"It started after that. I have a feeling it's all to do with Gregory."
Caris said, "You wouldn't have walked all this way, carrying a baby, because of something you just imagined."
"I know it sounds fanciful, but he just sits and glares at me hatefully. How can a man look at his wife like that?"
"Well, you've come to the right place," Caris said. "You're safe here."
"Can I stay?" she begged. "You won't send me back, will you?"
"Certainly not," said Caris. She caught Merthyn's eye. She knew what he was thinking. It would be rash to give Tilly a guarantee. Fugitives might take refuge in churches as a general principle, but it was very doubtful whether a nunnery had the right to shelter a knight's wife and keep her from him indefinitely. Moreover, Ralph would certainly be entitled to make her give up the baby, his son and heir. All the same, Caris put as much confidence into her voice as she could, and said, "You can stay here just as long as you like."
"Oh, thank you."
Caris silently prayed that she would be able to keep her promise. "You could live in one of the special guest rooms upstairs in the hospital," she said. Tilly looked troubled.
"But what if Ralph should come in?"
"He wouldn't dare. But if it makes you feel safer, you can have Mother Cecilia's old room at the end of the nuns' dormitory."
"Yes, please."
A priory servant came in to lay the table for dinner. Caris said to Tilly, "I'll take you to the refectory. You can have dinner with the nuns, then lie down in the dormitory and rest." She stood up. Suddenly she felt dizzy. She put a hand on the table to steady herself. Merthyn, still holding baby Jerry, said anxiously, "What's wrong?"
"I'll be fine in a moment," Caris said. "I'm just tired."
Then she fell to the floor. Merthyn felt a tidal wave of panic. For an instant he was stunned. Caris had never been ill, never helpless. She was the one who took care of the sick. He could not think of her as a victim. The moment passed like a blink. Fighting down his fear, he carefully handed the baby to Tilly. The servant girl had stopped laying the table and stood staring in shock at the unconscious form of Caris on the floor. Merthyn deliberately made his voice calm but urgent, and said to her, "Run to the hospital and tell them Mother Caris is ill. Bring Sister Una. Go on, now, quick as you can." She hurried away. Merthyn knelt beside Caris. "Can you hear me, my darling?" he said. He picked up her limp hand and patted it, then touched her cheek, then lifted an eyelid. She was out cold. Tilly said,
"She's got the plague, hasn't she?"
"Oh, God!" Merthyn took Caris in his arms. He was a slight man, but he had always been able to lift heavy objects, building stones and timber beams. He lifted her easily and stood upright, then laid her gently on the table.
"Don't die," he whispered. "Please don't die."
He kissed her forehead. Her skin was hot. He had felt it when they embraced a few minutes ago, but he had been too excited to worry. Perhaps that was why she had been so passionate. Fever could have that effect. Sister Una came in. Merthin was so grateful to see her that tears came to his eyes. She was a young nun, only a year or two out of her novitiate, but Caris thought highly of her nursing skill and was grooming her to take responsibility for the hospital one day. Una wrapped a linen mask over her mouth and nose and tied it in a knot behind her neck. Then she touched Caris's forehead and cheek.
"Did she sneeze?" she said.
Merthin wiped his eyes.
"No,"
he answered. He felt sure he would have noticed. A sneeze was an ominous sign. Una pulled down the front of Caris's robe. To Merthin she looked agonizingly vulnerable with her small breasts exposed, but he was glad to see there was no rash of purple-black spots on her chest. Una covered her up again. She looked up Caris's nostrils.
"No bleeding," she said.
She felt Caris's pulse thoughtfully. After a few moments, she looked at Merthin.
"This may not be the plague, but it seems a serious illness. She's feverish, her pulse is rapid, and her breathing is shallow. Carry her upstairs, lie her down, and bathe her face with rose water. Anyone who attends her must wear a mask and wash their hands as if she had the plague. That includes you." She gave him a linen strip.
Tears rolled down his face as he tied the mask. He carried Caris upstairs, put her on the mattress in her room, and straightened her clothing. The nuns brought rose water and vinegar. Merthin told them of Caris's instructions regarding Tilly, and they took the young mother and baby to the refectory. Merthin sat beside Caris, patting her forehead and cheeks with a rag damped with the fragrant liquid, praying for her to come round. At last she did. She opened her eyes, frowned in puzzlement, then looked anxious and said,
"What happened?"
"You fainted," he said. She tried to sit up.
"Keep still," he said.
"You're sick. It's probably not the plague, but you have a serious illness." She must have felt weak, for she lay back on the pillow without further protest.
"I'll just rest for an hour," she said.
She was in bed for 2 weeks. After 3 days, the whites of her eyes turned the color of mustard, and Sister Una said she had the yellow jaundice. Una prepared an infusion of herbs sweetened with honey, which Caris drank hot 3 times a day. The fever receded, but Caris remained weak. She inquired anxiously about Tilly every day, and Una answered her questions, but refused to discuss any other aspect of life in the nunnery, in case it should tire Caris. Caris was too enfeebled to fight her. Merthin did not leave the prior's palace. In the daytime, he sat downstairs, close enough to hear her call, and his employees came to him for instructions about the various buildings they were putting up or tearing down. At night, he lay on a mattress beside her and slept lightly, waking every time her breathing changed, or she turned over in her bed. Lola slept in the next room. At the end of the 1st week, Ralph showed up. "My wife has disappeared," he said, as he walked into the hall of the prior's palace. Merthin looked up from a drawing he was making on a large slate. "Hello, brother," he said. Ralph looked shifty, he thought. Clearly he had mixed feelings about Tilly's disappearance. He was not fond of her, but on the other hand, no man likes his wife to run away. "Perhaps I have mixed feelings too," Merthin thought guiltily. "After all, I did help his wife to leave him." Ralph sat on a bench. "Have you got any wine? I'm parched." Merthin went to the sideboard and poured from a jug. It crossed his mind to say he had no idea where Tilly could be, but his instinct revolted from the idea of lying to his own brother, especially about something so important. Besides, Tilly's presence at the priory could not be kept secret. Too many nuns, novices, and employees had seen her here. It was always best to be honest, Merthin thought, except in dire emergency. Handing the cup to Ralph, he said, "Tilly is here, at the nunnery, with the baby."
"I thought she might be."
Ralph lifted the cup in his left hand, showing the stumps of his 3 severed fingers. He took a long draught. What's the matter with her? She ran away from you, Ralph.
You should have let me know.
I feel bad about that, but I couldn't betray her. She's frightened of you.
Why take sides with her against me? I'm your brother.
Because I know you. If she's scared, there's probably a reason.
This is outrageous.
Ralph was trying to appear indignant, but the act was unconvincing. Merthyn wondered what he really felt.
We can't throw her out, Merthyn said. She's asked for sanctuary.
Jerry's my son and heir. You can't keep him from me.
Not indefinitely, no. If you start a legal action, I'm sure you'll win. But you wouldn't try to separate him from his mother, would you?
If he comes home, she will.
That was probably true. Merthyn was casting around for another way of persuading Ralph, when Brother Thomas came in, bringing Alan Fernhill with him. With his one hand, Thomas was holding Alan's arm, as if to prevent him from running away.
I found him snooping, he said.
I was just looking around, Alan protested. I thought the monastery was empty.
Merthyn said, as you see, it's not. We've got one monk, 6 novices, and a couple of dozen orphan boys.
Thomas said, anyway, he wasn't in the monastery. He was in the nuns' cloisters.
Merthyn frowned. He could hear a psalm being sung in the distance. Alan had timed his incursion well. All the nuns and novices were in the cathedral for the service of sext. Most of the priory buildings were deserted at this hour. Alan had probably been walking around unhindered for some time. This did not seem like idle curiosity. Thomas added, fortunately, a kitchen hand saw him and came to fetch me out of the church. Merthyn wondered what Alan had been looking for. Tilly? Surely he would not have dared to snatch her from a nunnery in broad daylight. He turned to Ralph. What are you two plotting? Ralph batted the question off to Alan.
What did you think you were doing?
He said wrathfully, though Merthyn thought the anger was faked. Alan shrugged.
Just looking around while I waited for you.
It was not plausible. Idle men-at-arms waited for their masters in stables and taverns, not cloisters.
Ralph said, Well, don't do it again.
Merthyn realized that Ralph was going to stick with this story. I was honest with him, but he's not being honest with me, he thought sadly. He returned to the more important subject. Why don't you leave Tilly B for a while? He said to Ralph. She'll be perfectly all right here, and perhaps after a while she'll realize you mean her no harm and come back to you.
It's too shaming, Ralph said.
Not really. A noble woman sometimes spends a few weeks at a monastery, if she feels the need to retire from the world for a while.
Usually when she's been widowed or her husband has gone off to war.
Not always, though.
When there's no obvious reason, people always say she wants to get away from her husband.
How bad is that? You might like some time away from your wife.
Perhaps you're right, Ralph said.
Merthyn was startled by this response. He had not expected Ralph to be so easily persuaded. It took him a moment to get over the surprise. Then he said, That's it. Give her 3 months, then come back and talk to her. Merthyn had a feeling that Tilly would never relent, but at least this proposal would postpone the crisis.
3 months, said Ralph.
All right.
He stood up to go. Merthyn shook his hand. How are mother and father? I haven't seen them for months.
Getting old. Father doesn't leave their house now.
I'll come and visit as soon as Caris is better. She's recovering from yellow jaundice.
Give her my best wishes.
Merthyn went to the door and watched Ralph and Alan ride away. He felt deeply disturbed. Ralph was up to something, and it was not simply getting Tilly back. He returned to his drawing and sat staring at it without seeing it for a long time. By the end of the 2nd week, it was clear that Caris was going to get better. Merthyn was exhausted, but happy. Feeling like a man reprieved, he put Lola to bed early and went out for the first time. It was a mild spring evening, and the sun and balmy air made him light-headed. His own tavern, the Bell, was closed for rebuilding, but the Hollybush was doing brisk business, customers sitting on benches outside with their tankards. There were so many people out enjoying the weather that Merthyn stopped and asked the drinkers if it was a holiday today, thinking he might have lost track of the date.
"Every day's a holiday now,"
one said.
"What's the point in working when we're all going to die of the plague? Have a cup of ale."
"No, thanks," Merthyn walked on. He noticed that many people wore very fancy clothes, elaborate headgear and embroidered tunics that they would not normally have been able to afford. He presumed they had inherited these garments, or perhaps just taken them from wealthy corpses. The effect was a bit nightmarish. Velvet hats on filthy hair, gold threads and food stains, ragged hose and jewel-encrusted shoes. He saw two men dressed all in women's clothing, floor-length gowns and wimples. They were walking along the main street arm in arm, like merchants' wives showing off their wealth. But they were unmistakably male, with big hands and feet and hair on their chins. Merthyn began to feel disoriented, as if nothing could be relied on any more. As the dusk thickened, he crossed the bridge to Leper Island. He had built a street of shops and taverns there, between the two parts of the bridge. The work was finished, but the buildings were untenanted, with boards nailed across their doors and windows to keep vagrants out. No one lived there but rabbits. The premises would remain empty until the plague died out, and Kingsbridge returned to normal, Merthyn supposed. If the plague never went away, they would never be occupied. But in that eventuality, renting his property would be the least of his worries. He returned to the old city just as the gate was closing. There seemed to be a huge party going on at the White Horse Inn. The house was full of lights, and a crowd filled the road in front of the building.
"What's going on?" Merthyn asked a drinker.
"Young Davy's got the plague, and he has no heirs to bequeath thee into, so he's giving all the ale away," the man said, grinning with delight. "Drink as much as you can hold. It's free!"
He and many other people had clearly been working on the same principle, and dozens of them were reeling drunk. Merthyn pushed his way into the crowd. Someone was banging a drum, and others were dancing. He saw a circle of men and looked over their shoulders to see what they were hiding. A very drunk woman of about 20 years was bending over a table while a man entered her from behind. Several other men were clearly waiting their turn. Merthyn turned away in distaste. At the side of the building, half concealed by empty barrels, his eye lit on Ozzy Osler, a wealthy horse dealer, kneeling in front of a younger man and sucking his penis. That was against the law. In fact, the penalty was death. But clearly no one cared. Ozzy, a married man who was on the parish guild, caught Merthyn's eye but did not stop. In fact, he continued with more enthusiasm, as if excited by being watched. Merthyn shook his head, amazed. Just outside the tavern door was a table laden with partly eaten food. Joints of roasted meat, smoked fish, puddings and cheese. A dog was standing on the table tearing at a ham. A man was throwing up into a bowl of stew. Beside the tavern door, Davy Whitehorse sat in a big wooden chair with a huge cup of wine. He was sneezing and sweating, and the characteristic trickle of blood came from his nose. But he was looking around and cheering the revelers on. He seemed to want to kill himself with drink before the plague finished him off. Merthyn felt nauseated. He left the scene and hurried back to the priory. To his surprise, he found Caris up and dressed.
"I'm better," she said. "I'm going to return to my usual work tomorrow."
Seeing his skeptical look, she added,
"Sister Una said I could."
"If you're taking orders from someone else, you can't be back to normal," he said, and she laughed. The sight brought tears to his eyes. She had not laughed for 2 weeks, and there had been moments when he had wondered whether he would ever hear the sound again.
"Where have you been?" she asked. He told her about his walk around the town and the disturbing sights he had seen. "None of it was very wicked," he said. "I just wonder what they'll do next. When all their inhibitions have gone, will they start to kill one another?" A kitchen hand brought a tureen of soup for their supper. Caris sipped warily. For a long time, all food had made her feel sick. However, she seemed to find the leek soup palatable and drank a bowlful. When the maid had cleared away, Caris said, "While I was ill, I thought a lot about dying." "You didn't ask for a priest." "Whether I've been good or bad, I don't think God will be fooled by a last-minute change of heart." "What, then?" "I asked myself if there was anything I really regretted."
"And was there?"
"Lots of things. I'm bad friends with my sister. I haven't any children. I lost that scarlet coat my father gave my mother on the day she died."
"How did you lose it?"
"I wasn't allowed to bring it with me when I entered the nunnery. I don't know what happened to it."
"What was your biggest regret?"
"There were two. I haven't built my hospital, and I've spent too little time in bed with you."
He raised his eyebrows. "Well, the second one is easily rectified."
"I know."
"What about the nuns?"
"Nobody cares any more. You saw what it was like in the town. Here in the nunnery, we're too busy dealing with the dying to fuss about the old rules. Joan and Una sleep together every night in one of the upstairs rooms of the hospital. It doesn't matter."
Merthyn frowned. "It's odd that they do that and still go to church services in the middle of the night. How do they reconcile the two things?"
"Listen. St. Luke's Gospel says, 'He that hath two coats, let him impart to him that hath none.' How do you think the Bishop of Shiring reconciles that with his chest full of robes? Everybody takes what they like from the teachings of the church and ignores the parts that don't suit them."
"And you?"
"I do the same, but I'm honest about it. So, I'm going to live with you as your wife. And if anyone questions me, I shall say that these are strange times."
She got up, went to the door, and barred it.
"You've been sleeping here for 2 weeks. Don't move out."
"You don't have to lock me in," he said with a laugh. "I'll stay voluntarily." He put his arms around her. She said,
"We started something a few minutes before I fainted. Tilly interrupted us."
"You were feverish."
"In that way, I still am."
"Perhaps we should pick up where we left off."
"We could go to bed first."
"All right." Holding hands, they went up the stairs. Chapter 71. Ralph and his men hid in the forest north of Kingsbridge, waiting. It was May, and the evenings were long. When night fell, Ralph encouraged the others to take a nap while he sat up, watching. With him were Alan Fernhill and 4 hired men, soldiers demobilized from the King's army, fighters who had failed to find their niche in peacetime. Alan had hired them at the Red Lion in Gloucester. They did not know who Ralph was and had never seen him in daylight. They would do as they were told, take their money, and ask no questions. Ralph stayed awake, noting the passing of time automatically, as he had when with the King in France. He found that if he tried too hard to figure out how many hours had gone by, he became doubtful. But if he simply guessed, what came into his head was always right. Monks used a burning candle, marked with rings, for the hours, or an hourglass with sand or water trickling through a narrow funnel. But Ralph had a better measure in his head. He sat very still with his back to a tree, staring into the low fire they had built. He could hear the rustle of small animals in the undergrowth, and the occasional hoot of a predatory owl. He never felt so calm as in the waiting hours before action. There was quiet and darkness and time to think. The knowledge of danger to come, which made most men jumpy, actually soothed him.
The main risk tonight did not in fact come from the hazards of fighting. There would be some hand-to-hand combat, but the enemy would consist of fat townsmen or soft-skinned monks. The real peril was that Ralph might be recognized. What he was about to do was shocking. It would be talked of with outrage in every church in the land, perhaps in Europe. Gregory Longfellow, for whom Ralph was doing this, would be the loudest in condemning it. If the fact ever got out that Ralph was the villain, he would be hanged. But if he succeeded, he would be the Earl of Shiring. When he judged it was 2 hours past midnight, he roused the others. They left their tethered horses and walked out of the woodland and along the road to the city. Alan was carrying the equipment, as he always had when they fought in France. He had a short ladder, a coil of rope, and a grappling iron they had used when attacking city walls in Normandy. In his belt were a mason's chisel and a hammer. They might not need these tools, but they had learned that it was best to be prepared. Alan also had several large sacks, rolled up tightly and tied with string in a bundle. When they came within sight of the city, Ralph gave out hoods with holes for the eyes and mouth, and they all put them on. Ralph also wore a mitten on his left hand to conceal the telltale stumps of his 3 missing fingers. He was completely unrecognizable, unless, of course, he should be captured. They all pulled felt bags over their boots, tying them to their knees to muffle their footsteps. It was hundreds of years since Kingsbridge had been attacked by an army, and security was slack, especially since the advent of the plague. Nevertheless, the southern entrance to the town was firmly closed. At the townward end of Merthyn's great bridge was a stone gatehouse barred with a mighty wooden door, but the river defended the town only on the east and south sides. To the north and west, no bridge was needed, and the town was protected by a wall that was in poor repair. That was why Ralph was approaching from the north. Mean houses huddled outside the walls, like dogs at the back of a butcher's shop. Alan had scouted the route several days ago, when the two of them had come to Kingsbridge and inquired about Tilly. Now Ralph and the hired men followed Alan, padding between the hovels as quietly as possible. Even paupers in the suburbs could raise the alarm if awakened. A dog barked, and Ralph tensed, but someone cursed the animal, and it fell silent. In another moment, they came to a place where the wall was broken down and they could easily clamber over the fallen stones. They found themselves in a narrow alley behind some warehouses. It came out just inside the north gate of the city. At the gate, Ralph knew, was a sentry in a booth. The 6 men approached silently. Although they were now within the walls, a sentry would question them if he saw them, and shout for help if he was not satisfied with their answers. But, to Ralph's relief, the man was fast asleep, sitting on a stool and leaning against the side of his box, a stub of candle guttering on a shelf beside him. All the same, Ralph decided not to risk the man's waking up. He tiptoed close, leaned into the booth, and slit the sentry's throat with a long knife. The man woke up and tried to scream with pain, but all that came out of his mouth was blood. As he slumped, Ralph caught him and held him for the few moments it took him to lose consciousness. Then he propped the body back up against the wall of the booth. He wiped his bloody blade on the dead man's tunic and sheathed the knife. The large double door that stopped the gateway had within it a smaller man-sized doorway. Ralph unbarred this little door, ready for a quick getaway later. The 6 men walked silently along the street that led to the priory. There was no moon. Ralph had chosen tonight for that reason, but they were faintly lit by starlight. He looked anxiously at the upstairs windows of the houses on either side. If sleepless people happened to look out, they would see the unmistakably sinister sight of 6 masked men. Fortunately, it was not quite warm enough to leave windows open at night, and all the shutters were closed. Just the same, Ralph pulled up the hood of his cloak and dragged it forward as far as it would go, in the hope of shadowing his face and concealing the mask. Then he signed to the others to do the same. This was the city where he had spent his adolescence, and the streets were familiar. His brother Merthin still lived here, although Ralph was not sure exactly where. They went down the main street, past the holly bush, closed for the night and locked up hours ago. They turned into the cathedral close. The entrance had tall, iron-bound timber gates, but they stood open, not having been closed for years, their hinges rusted and seized up. The priory was dark except for a dim light in the windows of the hospital. Ralph reckoned this would be the time when the monks and nuns were sleeping most deeply. In an hour or so they would be wakened for the service of matins, which started and finished before dawn. Alan, who had reconnoitred the priory, led the team around the north side of the church. They walked silently through the graveyard and past the prior's palace, then turned along the narrow strip of land that divided the east end of the cathedral from the river bank. Alan propped his short ladder up against a blank wall and whispered, "Nuns, cloisters, follow me." He went up the wall and over the roof. His feet made little noise on the slates. Happily, he did not need to use the grappling iron, which might have made an alarming clang. The others followed, Ralph last. On the inside, they dropped from the roof and landed with soft thumps on the turf of the quadrangle. Once there, Ralph looked warily at the regular stone columns of the cloisters around him. The arches seemed to stare at him like watchmen, but nothing stirred. It was a good thing monks and nuns were not allowed to have pet dogs. Alan led them around the deep-shadowed walkway and through a heavy door. "Kitchen," he whispered. The room was dimly lit by the embers of a big fire. "Move slowly, so that you don't knock over any pots." Ralph waited, letting his eyes adjust. Soon he could make out the outlines of a big table, several barrels, and a stack of cooking vessels. "Find somewhere to sit or lie down, and try to make yourselves comfortable," he said to them. "We stay here until they all get up and go into the church." Peering out of the kitchen an hour later, Ralph counted the nuns and novices shuffling out of the dormitory and heading through the cloisters towards the cathedral, some carrying lamps that threw antique shadows on the vaulted ceiling. 25, he whispered to Alan. As he had expected, Tilly was not among them. Visiting noblewomen were not expected to attend services in the middle of the night. When they had all disappeared, he moved. The others remained behind. There were only two places where Tilly might be sleeping, the hospital and the nuns' dormitory. Ralph had guessed she would feel safer in the dormitory and headed there first. He went softly up the stone steps, his boots still muffled by felt overshoes. He peeped into the dorm. It was lit by a single candle. He was hoping that all the nuns would be in the church, for he did not want miscellaneous people confusing the situation. He was afraid one or two might have stayed behind, because of illness or laziness. But the room was empty. Not even Tilly was there. He was about to retreat when he saw a door at the far end. He padded the length of the dormitory, picking up the candle, and went through the door silently. The unsteady light revealed the young head of his wife on a pillow, her hair in disarray around her face. She looked so innocent and pretty that Ralph felt a stab of remorse and had to remind himself of how much he hated her for standing in the way of his advancement. The baby, his son Jerry, lay in a crib next to her, eyes closed, mouth open, sleeping peacefully. Ralph crept closer and with a swift movement clamped his right hand hard over Tilly's mouth, waking her and at the same time stopping her making any noise. Tilly opened her eyes wide and stared at him in dread. He put the candle down. In his pocket he had an assortment of useful odds and ends, including rags and leather thongs. He stuffed a rag into Tilly's mouth to keep her quiet. Despite his mask and glove, he had a feeling she recognized him, even though he had not spoken. Perhaps she could smell him like a dog. It did not matter. She was not going to tell anyone. He tied her hands and feet with leather thongs. She was not struggling now, but she would later. He checked that her gag was secure. Then he settled down to wait. He could hear the singing from the church, a strong choir of females, and a ragged few male voices trying to match them. Tilly kept staring at him with big, pleading eyes. He turned her over so that he could not see her face. She had guessed he was going to kill her. She had read his mind. She must be a witch. Perhaps all women were witches. Anyway, she had known his intention almost as soon as he had formed it. She had started to watch him, especially in the evenings, her fearful eyes following him around the room, no matter what he did. She had lain stiff and alert beside him at night while he fell asleep, and in the mornings when he awoke, she was invariably up already. Then, after a few days of this, she had disappeared. Ralph and Alan had searched for her without success. Then he had heard a rumor that she had taken refuge in Kingsbridge Priory, which happened to fit in with his plans very neatly. The baby snuffled in his sleep, and it occurred to Ralph that he might cry. What if the nuns came back just then? He thought it through. One or two would probably come in here to see if Tilly needed help. He would just kill them, he decided. It would not be the first time. He had killed nuns in France. At last he heard them shuffling back into the dormitory. Alan would be watching from the kitchen, counting them as they returned. When they were all safely inside the room, Alan and the other four men would draw their swords and make their move. Ralph lifted Tilly to her feet. Her face was streaked with tears. He turned her so that her back was to him, then put an arm around her waist and lifted her, hoisting her onto his hip. She was as light as a child. He drew his long dagger. From outside, he heard a man say, "Silence, or you die!" It was Alan, he knew, although the hood muffled the voice. This was a crucial moment. There were other people on the premises, nuns and patients in the hospital, monks in their own quarters, and Ralph did not want them to appear and confuse the situation. Despite Alan's warning, there were several shouts of shock and shrieks of fear, but, Ralph thought, not too loud. So far, so good. He threw open the door and stepped into the dormitory, carrying Tilly on his hip. He could see by the light of the nuns' lamps. At the far end of the room, Alan had a woman in his grasp, his knife to her throat, in the same pose as Ralph with Tilly. Two more men stood behind Alan. The other two hirelings would be on guard at the foot of the stairs. "Listen to me," Ralph said. When he spoke, Tilly jerked convulsively. She had recognized his voice, but that did not matter so long as no one else did. There was a terrified silence. Ralph said, "Which of you is treasurer?" No one spoke. Ralph touched the edge of his blade to the skin of Tilly's throat. She began to struggle, but she was too small, and he held her easily. "Now," he thought, "now is the time to kill her." But he hesitated. He had killed many people, women as well as men, but suddenly it seemed terrible to stick a knife into the warm body of someone he had embraced and kissed and slept with, the woman who had borne his child. Also, he told himself, the effect on the nuns would be more shocking if one of their own died. He nodded to Alan. With one strong cut, Alan slit the throat of the nun he was holding. Blood gushed out of her neck onto the floor. Someone screamed. It was not merely a cry or a shriek, but a fortissimo yell of pure terror that might have awakened the dead, and it went on until one of the hired men hit the screamer a mighty blow over her head with his club, and she fell unconscious to the floor, blood trickling down her cheek. Ralph said again, "Which of you is treasurer?" Merthin had woken up briefly when the bell rang for matins, and Caris slipped out of bed. As usual, he turned over and fell into a light doze, so that when she returned it seemed as if she had been away only for a minute or two. She was cold when she got back into bed, and he drew her to him and wrapped his arms around her. They often stayed awake for a while, talking, and usually made love before going to sleep. It was Merthin's favorite time. She pressed up against him, her breasts squashed comfortably against his chest. He kissed her forehead. When she had warmed up, he reached between her legs and gently stroked the soft hair there. But she was feeling talkative. "Did you hear yesterday's rumor? Outlaws in the woods north of town." "It seems a bit unlikely," he said. "I don't know. The walls are decrepit on that side." "But what are they going to steal? Anything they want is theirs for the taking. If they need meat, there are thousands of sheep and cattle unguarded in the fields, with no one to claim ownership." "That's what makes it strange. These days, stealing is like leaning over the fence to breathe your neighbor's air." She sighed. 3 months ago, I thought this terrible plague was over." "How many more people have we lost?" "We've buried 1,000 since Easter." "That seemed about right to Merthyn. I hear that other towns are similar." He felt her hair move against his shoulder as she nodded in the dark. She said, "I believe something like 1/4 of the population of England is gone already, and more than half the priests. That's because they make contact with so many people every time they hold a service. They can hardly escape." "So half the churches are closed. A good thing, if you ask me. I'm sure crowds spread the plague faster than anything. Anyway, most people have lost respect for religion." To Caris, that was no great tragedy. She said, "Perhaps they'll stop believing in mumbo-jumbo medicine and start thinking about what treatments actually make a difference." "You say that, but it's hard for ordinary people to know what is a genuine cure and what a false remedy. I'll give you 4 rules." He smiled in the dark. She always had a list. "All right." 1, if there are dozens of different remedies for a complaint, you can be sure none of them works. Why? Because if one worked, people would forget the rest.
Logical.
2, just because a remedy is unpleasant doesn't mean it's any good. Raw lark's brains do nothing for a sore throat, even though they make you heave, whereas a nice cup of hot water and honey will soothe you.
That's good to know.
3, human and animal dung never does anyone any good. It usually makes them worse.
I'm relieved to hear it.
4, if the remedy looks like the disease, the spotted feathers of a thrush for the pox, say, or sheep's urine for yellow jaundice, it's probably imaginative rubbish. You should write a book about this. She made a scornful noise. Universities prefer ancient Greek texts.
Not a book for university students. One for people like you. Nuns and midwives and barbers and wise women.
Wise women and midwives can't read.
Some can, and others have people who can read for them.
I suppose people might like a little book that tells them what to do about the plague. She was thoughtful for a few moments. In the silence, there was a scream.
What was that? Merthyn said.
It sounded like a shrew being caught by an owl, she said.
No, it didn't, he said, and he got up.
One of the nuns stepped forward and addressed Ralph. She was young. They were nearly all young, with black hair and blue eyes.
Please, don't hurt Tilly, she begged. I'm Sister Joan, the treasurer. We'll give you anything you want. Please don't do any more violence.
I am Tam Hiding, Ralph said. Where are the keys to the nun's treasury?
I have them here on my belt.
Take me there.
Joan hesitated. Perhaps she sensed that Ralph did not know where the treasury was. On their reconnaissance trip, Alan had been able to scout the nunnery quite thoroughly before he was caught. He had plotted their way in, identified the kitchen as a good hiding place, and located the nun's dormitory, but he had not been able to find the treasury. Clearly, Joan did not want to reveal its location. Ralph had no time to lose. He did not know who might have heard that scream. He pressed the point of his knife into Tilly's throat until it drew blood.
I want to go to the treasury, he said.
All right. Just don't hurt Tilly. I'll show you the way.
I thought you would, Ralph said.
He left two of the hired men in the dormitory to keep the nuns quiet. He and Alan followed Joan down the steps to the cloisters, taking Tilly. At the foot of the stairs, the other two hired men were detaining at knife point three more nuns. Ralph guessed that those on duty in the hospital had come to investigate the scream. He was pleased. Another threat had been neutralized. But where were the monks? He sent the extra nuns up into the dormitory. He left one hired man on guard at the foot of the stairs and took the other with him. Joan led them into the refectory, which was at ground level directly under the dorm. Her flickering lamp revealed trestle tables, benches, a lectern, and a wall painting of Jesus at a wedding feast. At the far end of the room, Joan moved a table to reveal a trap door in the floor. It had a keyhole, just like a normal upright door. She turned a key in the lock and lifted the trap door. It gave on to a narrow spiral of stone steps. She descended the stairs. Ralph left the hired man on guard and went down, awkwardly carrying Tilly, and Alan followed him. Ralph reached the bottom of the staircase and looked around him with a satisfied air. This was the Holy of Holies, the nun's secret treasury. It was a cramped underground room, like a dungeon, but better built. The walls were of ashlar, smoothly squared off stones as used in the cathedral, and the floor was paved with closely set flagstones. The air felt cool and dry. Ralph put Tilly, trussed like a chicken, on the floor. Most of the room was taken up by a huge lidded box, like a coffin for a giant, chained to a ring in the wall. There was not much else. Two stools, a writing desk, and a shelf bearing a stack of parchment rolls, presumably the nunnery's account books. On a hook on the wall hung two heavy wool coats, and Ralph guessed they were for the treasurer and her assistant to wear when working down here in the coldest months of the winter. The box was far too large to have come down the staircase. It must have been brought here in pieces and assembled in situ. Ralph pointed to the clasp, and Joan unlocked it with another of the keys on her belt. Ralph looked inside. There were scores more parchment rolls, obviously all the charters and title deeds that proved the nunnery's ownership of its property and rights, a pile of leather and wool bags that undoubtedly held jeweled ornaments, and another, smaller chest that probably contained money. At this point, he had to be subtle. His object was those charters, but he did not want that to be apparent. He had to steal them, but appear not to have done so. He ordered Joan to open the small chest. It contained a few gold coins. Ralph was puzzled by how little money there was. Perhaps more was hidden somewhere in this room, possibly behind stones in the wall. However, he did not stop to ponder. He was only pretending to be interested in the money. He poured the coins into the purse at his belt. Meanwhile, Alan unrolled a capacious sack and began filling it with cathedral ornaments. Having let Joan see that, Ralph ordered her back up the stairs. Tilly was still here, watching with wide, terrified eyes, but it did not matter what she saw. She would never have a chance to tell. Ralph unrolled another sack and began loading the parchment rolls into it as fast as he could. When they had bagged everything, Ralph told Alan to break up the wooden chests with his hammer and chisel. He took the wool coats from the hook, bundled them up, and held the tip of his candle flame to the bundle. The wool caught fire immediately. He piled wood from the chests on top of the burning wool. Soon there was a merry bonfire, and the smoke caught in his throat. He looked at Tilly, lying helpless on the floor. He drew his knife. Then, once again, he hesitated. From the prior's palace, a small door led directly into the chapter house, which itself communicated with the north transept of the cathedral. Merthyn and Carys took this route in their search for the source of the scream. The chapter house was empty, and they went into the church. Their single candle was too dim to illuminate the vast interior, but they stood in the center of the crossing and listened hard. They heard the click of a latch. Merthyn said, "Who's there?" and was ashamed of the fear that made his voice tremble. "Brother Thomas," they heard, The voice came from the south transept. A moment later, Thomas moved into the light of their candle.
I thought I heard someone scream, he said.
So did we, but there's no one here in the church.
Let's look around.
What about the novices and the boys?
I told them to go back to sleep.
They passed through the south transept into the monks' cloisters. Once again they saw no one and heard nothing. From here, they followed a passage through the kitchen stores to the hospital. The patients lay in their beds as normal, some sleeping and some moving and groaning in pain. But, Merthin realized after a moment, there were no nuns in the room.
This is strange, said Karis.
The scream might have come from here, but there was no sign of emergency or of any kind of disturbance. They went into the kitchen, which was deserted, as they would have expected. Thomas sniffed deeply, as if trying to pick up a scent. Merthin said,
What is it?
He found himself whispering.
Monks are clean, Thomas murmured in reply. Someone dirty has been here.
Merthin could not smell anything unusual. Thomas picked up a cleaver, the kind a cook would use to chop through meat and bones. They went to the kitchen door. Thomas held up the stump of his left arm in a warning gesture and they halted. There was a faint light in the nuns' cloisters. It seemed to be coming from the recess at the near end. It was the reflected gleam of a distant candle, Merthin guessed. It might be coming from the nuns' refectory, or from the flight of stone steps that led up to their dormitory, or both. Thomas stepped out of his sandals and went forward, his bare feet making no sound on the flagstones. He melted into the shadows of the cloister. Merthin could just about make him out as he edged toward the recess. A faint but pungent aroma came to Merthin's nose. It was not the smell of dirty bodies that Thomas had detected in the kitchen, but something quite different and new. A moment later, Merthin identified it as smoke. Thomas must have picked it up too, for he froze in place up against the wall. Someone unseen gave a grunt of surprise, then a figure stepped out from the recess into the cloister walk, faintly but clearly visible, the weak light outlining the silhouette of a man with some kind of hood covering his entire head and face. The man turned towards the refectory door. Thomas struck. The cleaver glinted briefly in the dark. Then there was a sickening thud as it sank into the man's body. He gave a shout of terror and pain. As he fell, Thomas swung again, and the man's cry turned into a sickening gurgle, then stopped. He hit the stone pavement with a lifeless thump. Beside Merthin, Karis gasped with horror. Merthin ran forward.
What's going on? He cried.
Thomas turned to him, making go-back motions with the cleaver.
Quiet!
He hissed. The light changed in a heartbeat. Suddenly the cloisters were illuminated with the bright glow of a flame. Someone came running out of the refectory with a heavy tread. It was a big man carrying a sack in one hand and a blazing torch in the other. He looked like a ghost until Merthin realized he was wearing a crude hood with holes for the eyes and mouth. Thomas stepped in front of the running man and raised his cleaver, but he was a moment too late. Before he could strike, the man cannoned into him, sending him flying. Thomas crashed into a pillar, and there was a crack that sounded like his head hitting the stone. He slumped to the ground, out cold. The running man lost his balance and fell to his knees. Karis pushed past Merthin and knelt beside Thomas. Several more men appeared, all hooded, some carrying torches. It seemed to Merthin that some emerged from the refectory, and others came down the stairs from the dorm. At the same time, he heard the sound of women screaming and wailing. For a moment, the scene was chaos. Merthin rushed to Karis's side and tried to protect her with his body from the stampede. The intruders saw their fallen comrade, and they all paused in their rush, suddenly shocked into stillness. By the light of their torches, they could see that he was unquestionably dead, his neck sliced almost all the way through, his blood spilled copiously over the stone floor of the cloisters. They looked around, moving their heads from side to side, peering through the holes in their hoods, looking like fish in a stream. One of them spotted Thomas's cleaver, red with blood, lying on the ground next to Thomas and Caris, and pointed at it to show the others. With a grunt of anger, he drew a sword. Merthyn was terrified for Caris. He stepped forward, attracting the swordsman's attention. The man moved towards Merthyn and raised his weapon. Merthyn retreated, drawing the man away from Caris. As the danger to her receded, he felt more frightened for himself. Walking backwards, shaking with fear, he slipped on the dead man's blood. His feet flew from under him and he fell flat on his back. The swordsman stood over him, weapon raised high to kill him. Then one of the others intervened. He was the tallest of the intruders, and moved with surprising speed. With his left hand, he grabbed the upraised arm of Merthyn's assailant. He must have had authority, for without speaking, he simply shook his hooded head from side to side in negation, and the swordsman lowered his weapon obediently. Merthyn noticed that his saviour wore a mitten on his left hand, but nothing on the right. The interaction lasted only as long as it might take a man to count to 10, and ended as suddenly as it had begun. One of the hooded men turned towards the kitchen and broke into a run, and the others followed. They must have planned to escape that way, Merthyn realized. The kitchen had a door that gave on to the cathedral green, and that was the quickest way out. They disappeared, and without the blaze of their torches, the cloisters went dark. Merthyn stood still, unsure what to do. Should he run after the intruders? Go up to the dormitory and find out why the nuns were screaming? Or find out where the fire was? He knelt beside Caris. "Is Thomas alive?" he said. "I think he's banged his head, and he's unconscious. But he's breathing, and there's no blood." Behind him, Merthyn heard the familiar voice of Sister Joan. "Help me, please!" He turned. She stood in the doorway of the refectory, her face lit up grotesquely by the candle lamp in her hand, her head wreathed in smoke like a fashionable hat. "For God's sake, come quickly!" He stood up. Joan disappeared back into the refectory, and Merthyn ran after her. Her lamp threw confusing shadows, but he managed to avoid falling over the furniture as he followed her to the end of the room. Smoke was pouring from a hole in the floor. Merthyn saw immediately that the hole was the work of a careful builder. It was perfectly square, with neat edges and a well-made trapdoor. He guessed this was the nun's hidden treasury, built in secrecy by Jeremiah. But tonight's thieves had found it. He got a lungful of smoke and coughed. He wondered what was burning down there, and why. But he had no intention of finding out. It looked too dangerous. Then Joan screamed at him, "Tilly is in there!" "Dear God," Merthyn said despairingly, and he went down the steps. He had to hold his breath. He peered through the smoke. Despite his fear, his builder's eye noticed that the spiral stone staircase was well made, each step exactly the same size and shape, and each set at precisely the same angle to the next, so that he was able to go down with confidence, even when he could not see what was underfoot. In a second, he reached the underground chamber. He could see flames near the middle of the room. The heat was intense, and he knew he would not be able to stand it for more than a few instants. The smoke was thick. He was still holding his breath, but now his eyes began to water, and his vision blurred. He wiped his eyes with his sleeve and peered into the murk. Where was Tilly? He could not see the floor. He dropped to his knees. Visibility improved slightly. The smoke was less dense lower down. He moved around on all fours, staring into the corners of the room, sweeping with his hands where he could not see. "Tilly!" he shouted. "Tilly! Where are you?" The smoke caught in his throat, and he suffered a coughing fit that would have drowned any reply she made. He could not last any longer. He was coughing convulsively, but every breath seemed to choke him with more smoke. His eyes watered copiously, and he was nearly blind. In desperation, he went so close to the fire that the flames began to singe his sleeve. If he collapsed and lost consciousness, he would die for certain. Then his hand touched flesh. He grabbed. It was a human leg, a small leg, a girl's leg. He pulled her towards him. Her clothes were smoldering. He could hardly see her face, and could not tell whether she was conscious, but she was tied hand and foot with leather thongs, so she could not move of her own accord. Striving to stop coughing, he got his arms under her and picked her up. As soon as he stood upright, the smoke became blindingly thick. Suddenly, he could not remember which way the stairs were. He staggered away from the flames and crashed into the wall, almost dropping Tilly. Left or right? He went left and came to a corner. Changing his mind, he retraced his steps. He felt as if he was drowning. His strength gone, he dropped to his knees. That saved him. Once again he found he could see better close to the floor, and a stone step appeared, like a vision from heaven, right in front of him. Desperately holding on to the limp form of Tilly, he moved forward on his knees and made it to the staircase. With a last effort, he got to his feet. He put one foot on the lowest step and hauled himself up. Then he managed the next step. Coughing uncontrollably, he forced himself upward until there were no more steps. He staggered, fell to his knees, dropped Tilly, and collapsed on the refectory floor. Someone bent over him. He spluttered.
"Close the trap door! Stop the fire!"
A moment later, he heard a bang as the wooden door slammed shut. He was grabbed under the arms. He opened his eyes for a moment and saw Karis's face upside down. Then his vision blurred. She dragged him across the floor. The smoke thinned and he began to suck air into his lungs. He sensed the transition from indoors to out and tasted clean night air. Karis put him down and he heard her footsteps run back inside. He gasped, coughed, gasped and coughed. Slowly he began to breathe more normally. His eyes stopped watering and he saw that dawn was breaking. The faint light showed him a crowd of nuns standing around him. He sat upright. Karis and another nun dragged Tilly out of the refectory and put her beside him. Karis bent over her. Merthin tried to speak, coughed, and tried again.
"How is she?"
"She's been stabbed through the heart," Karis said. She began to cry. "She was dead before you got to her." Chapter 72. Merthin opened his eyes to bright daylight. He had slept late. The angle of the sun's rays, shining through the bedroom window, told him it was the middle of the morning. He recalled the events of the previous night like a bad dream, and for a moment he cherished the thought that they might not really have happened. But his chest hurt when he breathed, and the skin of his face was painfully scorched. The horror of Tilly's murder came back to him, and Sister Nelly, too, both innocent young women. How could God permit such things to happen? He realized what had awakened him when his eye lit on Karis, putting a tray down on the small table near the bed. Her back was to him, but he could tell, by the hunch of her shoulders and the set of her head, that she was angry. It was not surprising. She was grieving for Tilly, and enraged that the sanctity and safety of the nunnery had been violated. Merthin got up. Karis pulled two stools to the table and they both sat down. He studied her face fondly. There were lines of strain around her eyes. He wondered if she had slept. There was a smear of ash on her left cheek, so he licked his thumb and gently wiped it off. She had brought new bread with fresh butter and a jug of cider. Merthin found he was hungry and thirsty, and he tucked in. Karis, bottling up fury, ate nothing. Through a mouthful of bread, Merthin said,
"How is Thomas this morning?"
"He's lying down in the hospital. His head hurts, but he can talk coherently and answer questions, so there's probably no permanent damage to his brain. Good. There will have to be an inquest on Tilly and Nelly. I've sent a message to the Sheriff of Shiring. They will probably blame it on Tam Hiding. Tam Hiding is dead. He nodded. He knew what was coming. His spirits had been lifted by the breakfast, but now they sank again. He swallowed and pushed away his plate. Karis went on. Whoever it was that came here last night, he wanted to conceal his identity, so he told a lie, not knowing that Tam died in my hospital 3 months ago. Who do you think it could have been? Someone we know, hence the masks. Perhaps. Outlaws don't wear masks. It was true. Living outside the law, they did not care who knew about them and the crimes they committed. Last night's intruders were different. The masks strongly suggested they were respected citizens who were afraid of being recognized. Karis went on with merciless logic. They killed Nelly to make Joan open up the treasury, but they had no need to kill Tilly. They were already inside the treasury by then. They wanted her dead for some other reason, and they were not content to leave her to be suffocated by smoke and burned to death. They also stabbed her fatally. For some reason, they had to be sure she was dead. What does that tell you? Karis did not answer the question. Tilly thought Ralph wanted to kill her. I know. One of the hooded men was about to do away with you at one point. Her voice caught in her throat, and she had to stop. She took a sip of Mirthin cider, composing herself. Then she went on. But the leader stopped him. Why would he do that? They had already murdered a nun and a noblewoman. Why scruple to kill a mere builder? You think it was Ralph. Don't you? Yes. Mirthin sighed heavily. Did you see his mitten? I noticed he was wearing gloves. Mirthin shook his head. Only one. On his left hand. Not a glove with fingers, but a mitten. To hide his injury. I can't be sure, and we certainly couldn't prove anything, but I have a dreadful conviction about it. Karis stood up. Let's inspect the damage. They went to the nuns' cloisters. The novices and the orphans were cleaning the treasury, bringing sacks of charred wood and ashes up the spiral staircase, giving anything not completely destroyed to Sister Joan, and carrying the detritus out to the dunghill. Laid out on a refectory table, Mirthin saw the cathedral ornaments, gold and silver candlesticks, crucifixes and vessels, all finely wrought and studded with precious stones. He was surprised. "Didn't they take these?" he said. "Yes, but they seem to have had second thoughts and dumped them in a ditch outside town. A peasant on his way in with eggs to sell found them this morning. Luckily, he was honest." Mirthin picked up a gold aquamanile, a jug for washing the hands, made in the shape of a cockerel, the feathers of its neck beautifully chased. It's hard to sell something like this. Only a few people could afford to buy it, and most of those would guess it had been stolen. The thieves could have melted it down and sold the gold. Obviously, they decided that was too much trouble. Perhaps. She was not convinced, nor was Mirthin. His own explanation did not quite fit. The robbery had been carefully planned, that was evident. So why would the thieves not have made up their minds in advance about the ornaments, either to take them or leave them behind? Karis and Mirthin went down the steps and into the chamber, Mirthin's stomach clenching in fear as he was grimly reminded of last night's ordeal. More novices were cleaning the walls and floors with mops and buckets. Karis sent the novices away to take a break. When she and Mirthin were alone, she picked up a length of wood from a shelf and used it to prise up one of the flagstones underfoot. Mirthin had not previously noticed that the stone was not fitted as tightly as most, having a narrow gap all around it. Now he saw that underneath was a spacious vault containing a wooden box. Caris reached into the hole and pulled out the box. She opened it with a key from her belt. It was full of gold coins. Merthin was surprised. They missed that.
There are three more